the term digital redlining was coined because it was found that the internet service provider, the main provider in urban Cleveland, never upgraded the capacity from dial-up in the poor areas of Cleveland. And in fact, I have a side-by-side map of the historic redlining maps with the digital redlining maps, and it could be the same map.
Hi, and welcome to HIMSCast. I'm Kat Jersich, Senior Editor at Healthcare IT News, filling in this week for Jonah Comstock. Today's podcast is brought to you by Blue Jeans by Verizon. Blue Jeans is a leader in cloud video conferencing, and you can learn more at www.bluejeans.com. So, despite the widespread adoption of telehealth during the COVID-19 pandemic, we know that a lot of the deployments are still falling short of real user-friendliness, especially when it comes to users who might face other barriers to accessing medical care. So, joining me for this episode is Amy Schoen, Digital Health Equity Consultant, to speak about what providers can do to make their telehealth offerings useful and accessible for everyone. Amy, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So let's just get started with kind of your basic level set. How well are you seeing telehealth working out for patients in the COVID era?
Well, let's say this. It's working out a lot better now than it was at the beginning of the pandemic. I think that providers and health systems spent a good 6 months to really get all their equipment in place. And then I think it took them a few more months until they started realizing that they had a big equity issue on their hands, that they were connecting with video with some patients and not with other patients. And as it turns out, it's patients who are elderly and not comfortable with technology, people who lack devices or lack the robust connectivity needed for digital health, and the people who lack the basic skills to do telehealth. And then even people who have all that stuff and the basic skills, they might need encouragement, they might need instruction. And I think health systems are just starting to grapple with those pieces of it.
Hmm. Why did it take so long for them to kind of figure that out?
What a question. You know, I've spent about the last 6 or 8 years banging on the doors of healthcare systems saying, there's all this great digital health technology out there, like patient portals to electronic health records, but only a small fraction of your patients are using them. Can I talk to you about how, you know, why you should care about that and how to deal with it? Nothing. I got absolutely nowhere. And then along about September, those health systems started calling me. And I think what happened was they saw their second quarter results and realized that, you know, they were not connecting with elderly, they were not connecting with poor patients, rural, poor urban patients, patients with language differences or not speaking English as a first language. So they realized they had a big problem.
Wow. So in addition to that revelation, what are some other lessons that health systems have learned about telehealth and digital health technology as a whole during COVID?
So I think first is that the technology isn't necessarily very user-friendly. Mm. And I think there's been a lot in the health tech world trying out an app maybe on the friends and family members of the inventors and the developers. But what they obviously need to do is bring in people who have low digital skills and, you know, maybe old smartphones and, you know, maybe only a Wi-Fi hotspot or maybe only use the internet at the library and find out how it's working for them. Those are the people who stand to benefit most from it. And so their issues and concerns need to be recognized and dealt with right up front from the very beginning when technology is being developed.
Hmm. I know our listeners won't be able to see it, but when you said that innovators often are testing apps on family and friends, I made an excited face, but I wasn't excited about the fact. I was excited about the point, because that's a really, really salient point that I think gets overlooked a lot, where people will say, well, we tested this on our peers and they seem to like it fine, but they're not reaching out to the users who could stand to benefit the most for it. And so I'm wondering how they could find those users, or what are the best ways to make sure that your technology is being tailored to the needs of the people who do need it the most?
Oh, wow. That is a great, great question. And this comes down to community partnerships and working with people who are trusted by members of the community that you want to reach. Churches, libraries, these are places that are already engaging vulnerable patients, and those patients trust the services they get. Community health workers are a tremendous workforce that are starting to be used in some states, but not everywhere. And I really think they're a huge answer to this particular question, because they, depending on the state requirements, a community health worker might only have a high school education, but then additional training and certification. But importantly, they come from the communities that they're serving, and so they are trusted by the people that they're working with. So I would rather train a community health worker to be a digital navigator or a digital coach than try to train someone from healthcare how to become that trusted person.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We're seeing that a little bit with vaccine outreach as well, especially with
the difficulties
people face in terms of those technical hurdles, which is a different podcast topic, but I feel fairly strongly about that. Switching gears a little bit, I know that you're the research director for the Telehealth Equity Coalition, and I'd love if you could talk a little bit about what they do and how you got involved.
Sure. So the Telehealth Equity Coalition is the only national group that is focused on making sure that all populations can benefit from telehealth, and really not just telehealth, but digital health more broadly. So it was started out of the company Hims and Hers that has started with delivering sexual dysfunction services through telehealth, and then expanded into women's health, and they do mental health and reproductive health. And they, you know, really saw a need for this and had an institutional commitment to equity. So they stood it up, and now there's a couple hundred members who come from industry, tech companies, academic health systems, telehealth professional organizations, libraries, and then groups that represent disease interests or specific vulnerable populations like Native Americans or farm workers and the like. So it's a really, really diverse group of organizations, and that would be a wonderful place for companies looking to access vulnerable populations to reach out to the Telehealth Equity Coalition.
And so how did you get involved with them?
Well, they apparently realized right away that digital readiness was the main barrier, whether people had devices, connectivity, and digital skills. So they went to the lead organization in that regard, the National Digital Inclusion Alliance. I had, February before the pandemic, signed on as a senior fellow with the National Digital Inclusion Alliance because I was their member who had been most engaged in health, digital inclusion for health. So I'd signed on to be a senior fellow with them for a year, and the request came from the Telehealth Equity to NDIA, who said, we've got just the person for you.
That's wonderful. And so what are some of your initial findings with regard to telehealth use and usability and adoption? We touched on this a little bit, but maybe you could dive into some more of the details.
One of the things that the Telehealth Equity Coalition offers is a partnership with the National Health IT Collaborative for the Underserved, NHITC. NHITC operates something called the Data Fusion Center that they make available to tech members. And it's an open data platform with very granular data pertinent to telehealth, digital health, and equity. So there's a lot of information on social determinants of health and the health status of populations. And so, you know, you can look there and see, okay, we know that low users of telehealth are seniors, are Black and Hispanic and other disadvantaged minorities, non-English speakers, people in rural areas, people in poor urban areas. So we know that. So then you can go to the Data Fusion Center, and if you want to learn more about, well, how big of a problem is this, you know, nationwide? Where are the populations where there isn't good internet service? Right? So it's not going to do any good for a health system to really try to help people with telehealth if those people can't get internet where they live.
That's really helpful, yeah. And I mean, not just that they can't get internet, but that they can't afford internet, which is, I think, another issue that we're seeing as well, that internet's expensive. And in some places, it can get to $100 a month. And for some people, that puts it out of reach.
Well, and what many people don't know is that it's not random where internet is and where it isn't. And there's basically been very little regulation of internet service providers. I know in Cleveland, where I'm from, the term digital redlining was coined because it was found that the internet service provider, the main provider in urban Cleveland, never upgraded the capacity from dial-up in the poor areas of Cleveland. And in fact, I have a side-by-side map of the historic redlining maps with the digital redlining maps, and it could be the same map. You know, people don't realize that urban areas, there are many more people who don't have access who live in urban areas than rural areas.
Absolutely. In Chicago, where I am as well, you could overlay the maps and they would be nearly identical, as would a map of who has been most affected by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yes, that is the supreme irony, is that the people who could most benefit from telehealth because they have so many barriers to getting care are the ones who can't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see we're on the same page about a lot of grumpiness about city planning, to say the least, and inequity. So thinking about this foundation of knowing who and who is not using telehealth, what are some ways that vendors can ensure that their software is usable for everyone? We spoke about ensuring that they're being tailored to folks who could actually benefit from the product. Are there any other ways that kind of stand out to you?
Yeah, several. One, obviously, having low digital literacy populations working with them on development is key. Hmm. But once the product's out there, they should also work with those populations to develop the training resources. And I will say that there have been much better training resources that have become available in the last few months for telehealth. However, there are a couple of other things. One is tech support at the institutions that are offering telehealth. I know one world-renowned institution, their telehealth playbook says for the internal staff, here are the things we don't help patients with: their internet, their browser, their email, recovering their email password, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, oh, thanks for giving me the list of all the things that people need help with.
Uh-huh.
Now, who's going to take on this piece of it? And let's make it easy for the health systems to give the help that, you know, the tech support in that regard. The other thing they can do, this is especially to the electronic record companies, many of whom have the telehealth built in, is make it easy to look at the data. Hmm. I'm consulting with some institutions on trying to look at their telehealth data use from an equity point of view, and God, those the vendors could make this easy, and they've made it really hard. Mm. So let's get together. Maybe HIMSS could get us together, have a forum, and talk about how we could come up with a health equity analytics package. Hey, you heard it here first.
That would be very exciting. And you mentioned this a little bit about providers. I'm just imagining being a patient who can't find a link in an email and getting told that that's not something that they can be assisted with. That would be so frustrating, and I would feel like giving up, frankly. I would feel like, well, this is a hurdle to my care. I can't overcome that. So what are some other ways, besides offering that kind of basic technical support that you just outlined, that providers who maybe don't have a lot of choice in terms of the granular usability of their product, how can they make sure that their software is usable to the best of their degree?
I think a big issue is the workflow. Hmm. So they can make sure that they've got a workflow, and they build into that workflow helping patients. But I would say even before that, it's really got to start at the top of a health system, making some affirmative commitments. And these are the following. We think that it's good for your health for you to have internet. And not just internet on your mobile phone, but internet in your home. And we think that you should use internet for your health in the following ways. Use your portal, use telehealth. And we think that we should help you if you don't have a device and don't have connectivity. We think we should help refer you to people who can get you those things. And we think that we should help you get basic digital skill training. And then finally, we think we should help you be able to utilize our technology. Hmm. So digital navigators and digital health coaches are kind of the workflow to make that happen.
I can definitely see that. And as you were speaking, it reminded me of other social determinants of health programs that aim to connect patients with things like nutritious food or safe housing. And it's striking that internet access is not yet one of those basic determinants of health.
So you probably don't know this, but I just published a paper called Digital Inclusion as a Social Determinant of Health.
I did not know that.
You know, it's in one of those obscure journals, and it got published and didn't think much of it. And then a couple weeks ago, my LinkedIn started going crazy, all these people contacting me, and it turns out someone I don't know wrote a blog about our piece and how important it was. And now all these other people are writing blogs about it. So it feels like, you know, it's really getting out there. But I'm glad you mentioned the social determinants of health screening, because many health systems, especially if they're on value-based care and they're responsible for the health of someone, they realize that they have to help the person with their housing, food, et cetera. And the health systems that I'm consulting with, I'm having them connect with the apparatus in their health system that's already doing the screening and referral for social determinants of health. We've come up with some standard questions, just a couple of questions, to add to that screening for finding out if people need help with devices and connectivity. But they also have to have the referral partners lined up. Hmm. And the National Digital Inclusion Alliance is a great way to find organizations in their communities that can be their partners. But that's, you know, kind of like you have to have both pieces of that.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And no, I did not know about your paper, but I love that I accidentally invoked it. So we talked about vendors, we've talked about providers. Let's think about policymakers. We know that Biden's administration has taken some steps. For example, the FCC offered grants to families who may have trouble paying for internet. But what are some ways that our elected officials and policymakers can try to ensure that virtual care is usable for everyone and that it benefits everyone?
There are so many layers to that. The first one is around regulation of the internet. And if the government is going to give billions of dollars to internet service providers to start up new service, why don't you extract a commitment to them around equity, that you're going to, even though you're not going to make a lot of money, that you're going to make sure that everyone is served. The previous administration limited federal broadband funding resources to rural areas, even though that's only a quarter of people who have internet access problems. So we need equitable funding around that. The FCC has given out millions to billions in of dollars worth of devices and connectivity to benefit patients, but those funds could not be used for the digital navigation or the digital skill training. We know that just telling somebody where they can get low-cost internet doesn't work. Chances are they call and then they're told, oh, well, you need to upload, you know, X documentation of your eligibility for low-cost service. Well, guess what? They don't have the internet. How are they going to upload, you know, their stuff? Health insurance reimbursement. My partner is on Medicare, and every 90 days he gets a pile of money that he can use at the drugstore or for food or transportation or anything else. My gosh, let's put internet and devices, you know, in that list of things that can be reimbursed for. And Medicaid, obviously, this is a state-to-state issue. But let's get Medicaid reimbursement. Then, of course, there's the whole telehealth reimbursement and regulations itself, and that's just another whole huge entity of itself.
Yeah, what you said about digital health navigators in particular, I think, is so interesting and important, because I do think that there's a reluctance sometimes. I mean, this is just me as an observer, of course, and as a journalist who covers these issues, but to sort of like push money at a problem, which is great, but then not ensure that there are people who can take that funding and apply it in a practical setting. So, for example, I've spoken with researchers who have found that people with some disabilities find telehealth platforms to be completely unusable, because of, if you have a cognitive disability, you might not understand based on too much text, or if you have a reading disorder, if it's not accessible text, how to access that. And that's something that a care navigator, or that a digital navigator, I think could really, that's a role that a digital navigator could really step into.
Well, and ironically, this technology has so much potential for being able to help with barriers like that. You know, you can make the font big. You can make a keyboard with, you know, big keys. You can make a screen that only has a small number of icons on it. The dictation feature is so helpful for people who, you know, let's say a low income person with low education wants to message their doctor about a condition. They don't know how to spell something, but they can dictate it and it'll, you know, come up, right? And then the whole language translation and, you know, and even being able to have an audio transcription on the screen right while you're talking. These features could be so helpful for vulnerable populations. But people are maybe starting to think about it, but I think this could give us a huge boost.
Definitely. Yeah, you just named so many specific ways that platforms and software could be made more accessible. And it was just really striking how all the, as you named the specific ways that telehealth could be more accessible, I also saw all the ways that it is currently inaccessible.
Yes. And you know what, there's one more thing that I would really be remiss if I didn't mention, and that is asynchronous communication, right? So the notion where, you know, you're texting or messaging back and forth, or working with a chatbot or what have you, for patients who don't have internet or don't have a lot of internet or can't get on their devices certain times of day, asynchronous communication can be phenomenal. Now, it's not appropriate for every kind of medical indication, but say reproductive health, birth control, prescriptions, things like that, it's fantastic, right? And so we need to make sure that the reimbursement, you know, is appropriate for that. But we also need to make sure that that's not kind of a cop-out for people who don't have the internet but want it. If someone's doing something asynchronously, it should be because it makes sense, it's the right technology, and it's because the person prefers it rather than video, face-to-face, live communication.
That's a great point. Thank you for mentioning that. And of course, that is another thing that we may run into issues with reimbursement. But again, that's a whole other podcast topic. And I know we've been chatting for a while and it's almost time to wrap up, but I'm wondering, looking to the future, what are some of your hopes in terms of telehealth and virtual care?
Oh, thank you for asking that. My vision for years and years has been that health systems would routinely screen every patient for digital connectivity, digital skills, devices, etc. And, you know, healthcare, a lot of healthcare institutions have joined up as part of a National Healthcare Anchor Institution program where they recognize the incredible bully pulpit and weight economic force that they can be in many communities. Some of them, including MetroHealth in Cleveland, and in fact, Cleveland Clinic and University Hospitals are three big health systems, are all building out internet in neighborhoods around their facilities. New technology with the antennas, the receivers that you can put on a high building, that it can really easily get into dense urban areas. So having health systems realize the power that they have to make this transformational impact on their patients. You know, great, you're offering a farmer's market once a week. That's great. Give somebody the internet and the ability to use it. Think of how you've transformed their lives.
Well, thank you so much again, Amy. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that you all asked and that you asked the right questions. So you've got an important listening audience, and I hope they take this all to heart because they've got an opportunity to make a difference.
Me too. And to that listening audience, thank you so much for joining us today for today's podcast, which was brought to you by Blue Jeans by Verizon. Blue Jeans is a leader in cloud video conferencing, and you can learn more at www.bluejeans.com. Thanks again for listening. Like, subscribe, rate us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. I'm showing my iTunes age there. And stay safe, everybody.
Thank you.